I'm here today with the lovely Liz Lambert. Liz, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Vinny.
Tell us what you've got for us today.
Well, I thought the listeners might like an update on what's happening with the Crayfer Farms. Since we spoke last time, the receivers have made a move, and they don't actually put it in their own names because they don't have standing to make a statement of claim or file for what's called an interlocutory application. So what's been served on me and was served on me on the 5th was a statement of claim and an interlocutory application. Well, it's an application for an interlocutory application, attempting to jump in before the statement of claim gets heard, because listeners may or may not know that it's all right, they're not coming in their helicopter yet.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, it sounds like some deer hunters about to swoop in and shoot you with a net gun.
Maybe. Okay. So, yeah, the statement of claim, the listeners may or may not know, people have got what's called a statement of defence that they can put forward. If you don't do that, then pretty much they get their own way. But anyway, you've got 25 working days to file that. In the meantime, so as I was saying, on the 5th they served these documents on me, which included the statement of claims about, oh, I don't know, 20 pages long, and the interlocutory application is about half that. But there's also two volumes of affidavit that goes with that. Now, I think this is going to be another $18,000 to $20,000 little handover to the lawyers for the receivers, because that's pretty much what they get. They get paid to produce that amount of paper. So anyway,
I've always wondered and been mystified by just how much legal bills cost. I mean, it's like you're hiring a solid gold robot to perform eye surgery or something.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because as I say, I've got an idea of about how much two volumes cost now, because when the receivers, and they acted in their own name in that stage, at that stage, no, they didn't. They acted in the name of the Farms and Receivership, that's right, got caveats removed in the court. They also applied for they had to put an affidavit in as to their costs, and they had to break down for the court how they were reached. Well, there were about, I think from memory in the affidavit, there were about 8 lawyers named, ranging from the partner in the law firm down to the summer clerk. And the summer clerk would be amused to know that that he got paid $90 an hour. Because as far as I remember from summer clerks, I never got a summer clerkship, by the way. But I don't think they paid them anywhere $90 an hour, if they paid them anything. So that was for his research. Now, the top paid person was $790 an hour, and that was one of the partners in the firm. So you got a range of people, and it's actually who does the least gets paid the most, and who does the most gets paid the least. So the summer clerk probably was supposed to keep an eye on the caveat situation the whole time, and had probably the most stressful job of the lot, but got paid $90 an hour. So, and then the man who came down into the court, he got paid $790 an hour. But people like barristers, because this guy's who came to court this last time, he's probably a barrister as well, but he's paid as an in-house lawyer, you know, a corporate lawyer in that case. So $790 is pretty cheap. The barristers get paid, you know, $1,000 upwards an hour. So yeah, that's how they arrive at it. So we were off the track, but.
Well, so they actually work it out by the hour.
Yes.
So yes. It's not like by the question, you know, like $1,000 a question or something like
No. So it depends on how fast you read, I suppose, or there is a kind of a schedule.
Because I've been into court, and generally the lawyers talk incredibly slowly. Are they trying to milk the system?
Maybe. maybe there's method in their madness, you know. We were thinking they were gathering their profound thoughts, but it would appear that
the longer you can
string it out, the more you can get paid. So at some stage, I'll probably scan that in and send it over to you for your viewer's delight. It actually names the lawyers too, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, so ladies and gentlemen, if you ever...
served on me, I guess it's my piece of information.
Yeah, so ladies and gentlemen listening, if you ever need a legal job done that will bankrupt you, these are the guys to hire.
Yeah, I think they're pretty standard costings. So getting back to statements of claim and interlocutory applications, what they said in the statements of claim, they have claimed 5 causes of action against me, which are... what are they? And this is the farms claiming. They're claiming that I've done all of these things, which they're quite correct in. But against those, they have to have what's called legal hooks to hang them on. So the first cause of action is a breach of Section 9 of the Fair Trading Act, which was a kind of surprising one for me. I'm not usually surprised by what they get up to, but anyway, they're saying that I made all these representations, for example, that I'm the owner of the Crayford Farms, and that the land is my land, and they're wanting a remedy under the Fair Trading Act 1986 because they say that I make these claims in trade.
Sounds like some creative litigation going on.
You've got to keep your billing up, don't you? So there's that one. So the second one is a permanent injunction restraining the defendant and her associates, assigns, representatives and agents from making representation set out in paragraph 32 above, which is all the representations that I make about that they're the farms are mine, they're now debt free because I don't owe a debt to Westpac. And all sorts of other things, and that in actual fact the the farms in receivership are trespassing on my land, and as are the people who work there. But you know, I don't want to have a go at them. So then they want a permanent injunction restraining me from either orally or in writing making these representations to the share milkers and to third parties. So that would include you. So this is why I'm keen to get this known, so that if they were to succeed, then everybody knows before the fact anyway. But I'll tell you in a minute why I think they're trying this on, because I don't think they're going to get this injunction. Then they want a declaration that the purported sale and purchase agreements are invalid and of no effect. Well, that's going to be interesting, and that's the substantial matter that lies behind all of this. They want an inquiry into damages in respect of the losses sustained by the plaintiffs as a consequence of the defendant's conduct in this matter. So that means the farms themselves, because the plaintiffs are the farms. So what damage I might have done to their business. For example, share milkers might have decided that, oh, yes, that's a good idea. I might think about going when Liz gets her farms, I might think of working for her, which was what I encouraged them to do. And then they want interest, and they want solicitor clients' costs on a full indemnity basis. So it might be even more than $20,000. It could be lots more. They might get a lot of other lawyers who said they had something to do with putting this together as well.
So don't you wish that the law was simple so that people could actually understand it without paying people $20,000 for twiddling their thumbs?
Well, I think lawyers go in to become lawyers. They have a different idea of the law, and when they get in, they find that it's just a billing exercise, you know. I think lawyers might be quite pleased if that were the case as well. That, you know, I do some work at the community advice centre here, and I do it voluntarily, and most of the things. Because it's not paid work, and so it's no skin off my nose what people pay or don't pay. A lot of these things people can do themselves. But they do often need legal advice so that they can do it themselves. And so it's a bit of a bind, I suppose, if you're trying to make your living out of being a lawyer.
Well, see, this is the thing. It's about the old teaching a man to fish concept, is that lawyers, do they teach you how to be lawyers in general, or do they just say, don't worry about this, just pay me?
Do they teach, you mean in law school?
Yeah, do they teach lawyers how to teach other people to be do their own legal skills?
No, definitely not. No, nothing like that.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah, so how they overcome that, you know, is they say, well, if you have to have a lawyer and you can't afford it, then you can get legal aid. And most people think, oh, that's nice, I'm being aided. But they're not being aided. The lawyers are being aided. The legal aid that people get is put as a charge. If they've got any property, it sits as a charge, a caveat against their property. So they get it when you're dead and gone, perhaps, if you've got anything by then, or they don't, or the community has to wear it. But the money all goes to the lawyer, doesn't go to the person who's trying to pursue the litigation.
That's just weird. I mean, do lawyers almost take ownership of people's property or get them into debt as a result?
No, the lawyers don't get the property. What happens is the legal aid is advanced through the legal aid fund to the lawyer to do the work, so they get the money. And then once the person's passed on or if they are in a position to repay that legal aid, it goes back into the legal aid fund, or the legal aid fund itself would take part of the proceeds of a sale of a property, for example, to reimburse itself.
Okay.
That's how it works. Anyway, the second and alternative cause of action is that that I made malicious falsehood, I said that I owned the farms when they said in the High Court in Rotorua that I didn't have an arguable case, that I was a bona fide purchaser for value. Well, that's a different thing, actually, to holding anything in particular. And then they're talking about the Tenancy Tribunal. Well, they actually declined jurisdiction, the Tenancy Tribunal, so they didn't actually have anything to say about that. They just parroted what the court at Rotorua had said. And then the other reason, they say that so that they'd explained to me, I like this one, the particulars of it is that by letter of the 26th of September, the plaintiff's solicitors explained to the defendant the basis upon which the defendant had no claim to or interest or right in any of the Crafer farms, and the reasons why the purported sale and purchase agreements are invalid and of no effect. So, you know, it's kind of like, well, we told you, so you should have listened to us, except they've got no legal basis to hang that on. Okay, what else do they want? So they want a permanent injunction about all of this and stopping me doing anything or saying anything.
I hear this word injunction a lot in court, and I still don't exactly know what it means.
Oh, gosh, you got me there because, you know, it's one of those words that you bandy about without having thought about it. I suppose it's kind of like you can't, for example, you can't start get an interlocutory, because interlocutory means within the body of what's going on, if you like. So you can't get that interlocutory injunction without something going on, so it can't just come out of the blue. But it's kind of like, let's stop before we get into the trial and do something else. We've got something else to say. I suppose it's something a bit like that. It's also it's what's called an equitable remedy. So it's to stop people doing things usually.
Okay. Well.
Yeah. That's what it is. Sorry.
Economic remedy. I mean, can you back currency?
Sometimes it's economic. Sometimes it's, for example, they want to stifle. They want to stop freedom of speech here.
So can you back currency with it, like injunction we trust?
Yeah, well, I don't know.
I'm just joking, perhaps, of course.
Yeah, perhaps. So, yeah, so it's to stop people doing things until the substantive matter can be heard, pretty much.
Right.
So the third cause of action is interference in business relations by unlawful means, which is kind of a rerun of that, you know, in trade stuff. And something about the share milkers, and a particular share milker down in Hamilton being scared and having to come back from a family do because I'd turned up at the door and blah, blah, blah. And then they want a permanent injunction about that as well. And then the fourth course of action. Now, this is the really interesting one. They say that in the proceedings, blah, 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 that the caveats that I lodged were lodged vexatiously and with an improper motive as part of the defendant's continued and determined effort to obstruct the receivership and operation of the companies. And then the plaintiffs repeat all the paragraphs, blah, blah. And then they say there is reason to suspect that the defendant will attempt to register new caveats against the titles to the Crafer Farms. If that occurs, the plaintiffs are likely to suffer loss and damage, which the defendant will be unable to compensate. The defendant's me, by the way. Now, the particulars are they repeat all of the stuff about what I've done. And then they say the defendant has lodged two new caveats against the titles to the Lakeview Farm and the Kay Road Farm. So from what they say, and I haven't checked it yet, I'd say those caveats are still current. Then they say, if the defendant successfully registers further caveats against the titles to the Crafer Farms, this may prevent the Crafer companies from being able to settle the Peng Shing agreement. Right? You know what the Peng Shing agreement is, eh? You there?
Yeah, I'm here.
The Peng Shing agreement is the Chinese deal.
Well, explain to me, like, what the deal is with their particular interest in all of this. I mean, I'm not sure what happens to farms once they get placed into receivership. I mean, are the banks and the lawyers just out to find another buyer, and that's where they come in? Or
this is the interesting point, because one of the things that they say, and I'll give you a short rundown on what I've replied to all of this, is that. Once your business is in receivership, the right to sell vests solely in the receivers. Now, they don't quote, man, I'd like to see one piece of law that backs that statement up. That is not true. In fact, the Receiverships Act itself contemplates a situation where the company in receivership sells its property. So that's rubbish. So anyway, they say, and they admit it, that if I successfully register further caveats against the titles to the Crafer Farms, this may prevent the Crafer companies from being able to settle the Peng Shing agreement. And then they say at D, if for any reason the Peng Shing agreement is not completed and the defendant registers further caveats against the titles to the Crafer Farms, those caveats will prevent the receivers and the plaintiffs from marketing the properties for sale and or entering into negotiations with other purchasers.
Okay.
Now, when I read that, I was absolutely delighted, because it's exactly what I set out to do, was to put those caveats up as a warning and to stop the marketing of those properties.
Does that mean, in essence, you've kind of sabotaged, in a way, what these people want to do with the farms?
Yes, that's correct.
Well, no wonder they're not happy.
They're very unhappy.
Well, how much are you costing them? I mean, let's say you're successful, and what's your end game here, Liz? What are you trying to do with these farms?
Well, I've got lessees to farm them. The Crafers themselves have got three leases that they haven't done anything with. And I've got other people to lease every farm. And what I want to see is debt-free farms, and to show how successful they are for our country. In actual fact, it's more and more evidence is coming to light as well in terms of mortgages. I haven't been concentrating much on the money side of it at the moment, but more and more light is coming, is being shed on what's going on with securitisation of mortgages. And there's they've got themselves so strung out, the banks, that basically they're cutting the links between the debtor and the creditor. So they're getting things like pension funds and you know, private investors to pour money into the into buying bonds, and then they're securitizing mortgages, and then they're doing a whole lot of, it's a symphony of financial instruments in between those two ends of that transaction. The latest from the States is that all of that to-ing and fro-ing has cut the matrix, if you like, between the who can claim on a loan and who against the borrower. And that seems to be lost in a real mess of transactions, because we're not just talking about transactions in New Zealand. We're talking about how they move into the worldwide banking system. So, you know, whether the crafers in the end of all of this, once I've got the farms and the banks are still pursuing them for the $250 million, it might be interesting for them to have a look at, has there been too much mucking around with the borrowings and the loans, etc., by the banking system itself to make their claim that they can sell up farms stick, because it's starting to come unstuck in the United States.
Well, what's happened in the United States, I've found, is that you were talking about securitizing mortgages using pension funds and all of that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Well, basically, these operations have been conducted with Wall Street criminal banksters, and the ultimate thing is just to on-sell those mortgages to unsuspecting people with their fake credit rating agencies or whatever, and leave all the people holding these bags full of fake debt that doesn't really exist.
Yes, that's pretty much it. But what they've failed, and this is often what they get so immersed in their wheeling and dealing, that they fail to think about the if it all falls to pieces, which I've been reading an expert affidavit this morning that this guy who has worked in securities, etc., in the United States, and he's a lawyer as well, is saying they've been set up to fail. And the affidavit I was reading is kind of like an expert witness statement, is that Goldman Sachs were behind this particular scheme in the States. And it reminded me of a couple of years ago. I remember when milk was being, or milk solids were being described as white gold, and all of the rural communities, I was living in Taranaki at that stage, and all the rural communities were getting a bit excited, and the man from Goldman Sachs came on the radio and said, oh well, the farmers actually won't be, you know, although the milk checks up, they won't be getting, you know, it won't be coming out to be spent because they have to retire the debt with it. So, you know, what the analysis of this affidavit I was reading this morning is that in actual fact, they set up the mortgages knowing that they were going to fail, but they were insured for that. And so they collected the insurances, which people don't know about. And
that's basically like putting put options, or rather, it's more closely akin to gambling, but gambling with other people's money and having no risk.
Well, yeah, well, that's right. Yeah, put option is a good example of it. Really, you know, that's it's going to go. The price is going to go down.
So they start up these operations knowing they're going to fail, and then insure them so that they get a huge payout when it does fail.
It's kind of like making sure that you've got a lot of value in a building and insuring it, or maybe even over-insuring it, and then, oh, someone else burnt it down. It wasn't me, though.
Well, the World Trade Center, for instance, got, I think, what, extra terrorism insurance a few weeks or so before they came down.
Right.
And they had planned for controlled demolition to remodel them and build the new Freedom Tower kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the EPA said that they couldn't because they're asbestos-laden buildings, and the all the damage from the dust and everything that would have gone everywhere had they done a controlled demolition would have been a major, major, major disaster.
Oh, so they wanted to get rid of that building?
Yeah, they'd been planning for it for years. They'd even gotten people to come in to bid for contracts for asbestos removal in lieu of the controlled demolition. They found out that it would have been almost twice as expensive as blowing it up and then building a whole new set of towers.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds like a lot of, you know, when people start to lose money on things, and they've got, you know, insurance companies or they've got banks in their pockets, they can do all sorts of creative accounting on protect themselves and make money at the same time.
Well, they're all juggling these big financial balls, and other people, they just see this guy passing his hands back and forth, and they don't see that he's actually juggling real balls that have real money that can really destroy people's lives.
That's right. So as I say, you were asking about the interlocutory application. It's really for to say, look, something needs to be stopped here because, you know, and they make the case that, you know, it's damaging their business. I'm sitting up here in Huntley, you know, really damaging the business of the farms. So they say that they want this done. Now, they got a hearing date for tomorrow down in Hamilton. So I put in the my opposition to the application, and I put in an affidavit supporting that, basically saying, and I think that the last couple of paragraphs that I put in my affidavit explain my view of why they're doing it. Now there's a number of cases and some high court rules that really say they can't do this while the main point is about to be tried. You know, it's so I've covered all of that. But then in the last two paragraphs, I say the plaintiffs complain in their statement of claim that the Pengsheng agreement may not be able to be settled if I'm allowed to place further caveats against the titles. However, the plaintiffs also plead that if for any reason the Pengsheng agreement is not completed and a defendant registers further caveats against the titles of the Crafer Farms, those caveats will prevent the receivers and the plaintiffs from marketing the properties for sale and or entering into negotiations with other purchasers. Paragraph 10, I say, the reports in the media have been that a decision on the sale will be reached by the end of April. The plaintiffs appear to be attempting to complete a sale to Pengsheng under false pretenses by not allowing the argument over the sale and purchase agreements to be aired until after this deadline at the end of the month has passed. Okay, so and then I say I oppose it. So, you know, I'm calling them on it. I'm saying, you know, I think that you're trying to get this, you keep it quiet and away from Pengsheng's ears until, you know, you've got the political machinations done.
It's kind of like they're attempting to keep it secret from the buyer. Like it's like a con man, for instance, he'll try and sell you a car that's pretty substandard or whatever, and so naturally, instead of showing you everything about the car and in great detail and answering all your questions and whatever, he just gives you a quick gloss over and then demands that you sign the paperwork. And if you start asking questions, he starts to get a little bit edgy and tries to encourage you yet again to sign the paperwork so that you can take away this.
As soon as
you're
on, I mean, they are saying, oh, well, and I think that they think that if they can get Pengsheng to sign, well, Pengsheng has signed, and, you know, the condition was on that agreement that the Overseas Investment Office had to give their agreement. So it was a conditional agreement. Now, it became unconditional at the stage that the Overseas Investment Office said yes, but then it became unconditional again. Sorry, it became conditional again when the High Court said no. You've got to go back and look at it again. Now, it can become unconditional again. And this is what they're trying to do. They're trying to get it unconditional before the end of the month, because that's when they said they'll do it. But to get it unconditional, they've got to keep this from the ears of the Pengsheng, lawyers or whatever.
Well, why don't we just send this audio to them then?
Who's the Pengsheng lawyers? That would be a good idea, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Pengsheng, I mean, are they a big company?
I don't know.
They're bound to have.
I don't know.
They must be a big company if they can buy.
They're pretty big. I think they're bigger in mining than they are in dairying.
Well, they must have a website.
I seem to remember reading that they're not too bothered if they don't get the farms because they've got other things that they're going to be trying to invest in anyway.
So in that case, if we did send them this and they said that this farm that you can kind of take or leave, there's a whole lot of bad stuff going around, and then they'll leave it.
yeah, just leave it, guys.
I mean, it'll be the straw that broke the camel's back.
That would be perfect, because that's it then. As they've pleaded in their injunction, their application for the injunction, and in the statement of claim, that they then cannot negotiate with other purchasers or market the properties, because basically, you know, they haven't got another pig in the poke. They haven't got another live one on the line. And having had this notice that the caveats provide, and I have provided to them in various ways by, you know, writing to the share milkers, informing the receivers of what the situation is, etc., etc. They cannot now in good faith do any negotiations any further. Now, people might say, well, you know, what about our relationship with the Chinese? Because everybody suddenly seems to think that's a great big, the big one here. If the Chinese are interested in the dairy product, and of course we can't use all of the dairy product we produce in this country, no way. Although it could be a darn sight cheaper. I'd be happy to look at a couple of 25-year leases or something. I haven't leased all of the farm. Well, I've leased all of the farms, but some of them I've leased just on 1-year contracts, just until I see how things are going to pan out. So there's no reason why, you know, if they are, you know, crying out for good protein, that we can't supply them.
Well, I think, and, you know, New
maybe
Zealand
they'll
has
set,
such...
maybe they'll set the scene for they won't be coming in and trying to buy other farms. But I don't think that they're bothered about leasing it either. In terms of getting the milk product, but the bank, you see. The bank is doesn't get their money if the farms are leased. Then whoever's got the farms in their control at the time, if it's another farm, any other farms that they're trying to buy milk off, it really makes the value of the farm transparent, doesn't it? Because they're paying for what's being produced on the farm, rather than someone, you know,
so it's not just endlessly paying rent.
The bank has got a real measure of what the farm is producing.
Well, the way I see New Zealand farming is that it's probably it's anathema to all the rest of the economy, essentially. The rest of the economy in New Zealand that we've got here is just basically service industry and maybe a few tiny technology companies that aren't pulling the rest of the country along. But we were centrally focused on farming as a nation. And now it appears as though debt is destroying that fact.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and if it destroys our farms, It destroys all of us.
That's the rest of the nation gone. I mean, if a nation is incapable of feeding itself and actually making just feeding yourself a profitable industry, then you got nothing.
Mm.
You're going to be easily conquered.
Mm. Yeah, well, the banks aren't bothered.
Well, I think I'm fairly certain it's the banks that are consciously engaging in a war against private ownership.
Yes.
Largely.
Yes. Yeah, they certainly are. Well, I think we spoke in the last time about they were that Westpac, who's the bank behind all of this. Westpac actively worked against the Crayford companies in that it was going to provide the other $100 million for the deal previous to this deal. Hmm.
So what are we supposed to do? What are we supposed to do in this particular situation? I mean, you've seemed to be holding the fort. But you're not doing it by yourself, though, are you?
Pretty much. I'll tell you what, Vinny. Other lawyers don't like me very much.
Well, I suppose jealousy is permeated throughout the entire industry, isn't it?
Well, whether they think that, some people just say I'm crazy, that's all.
Well, crazy is just another word for
crazy people, I don't know. But I certainly don't get a whole lot of lawyers putting up their hands to help me.
Yeah, well, crazy is just another word for somebody who knows something that you don't know.
Maybe.
Who can see something that you can't see. So the thing is, it's not that you're crazy, is it that it's just that they can't see. Not entirely dissimilar from how a shaman...
Yeah, what can we do? I think that your suggestion about if it can be some way fed to the Pengsheng lawyers, the Pengsheng company itself or someone who's not a lawyer, because to a certain extent the lawyers are gatekeeping in all of this. They see that their role is going to be, some people are going to be very embarrassed, and their role is going to be suspect in the way they've assisted the banks to do a lot of this stuff as well.
Yeah.
The bankers themselves, I don't think that they're particularly, they're not as devious. Or they don't see how they can do all of these things. I mean, the lawyers set it up so it can be done legally. There's really not a lot of illegality going on.
Mm.
They're very careful, and that shows me that lawyers are in the picture.
Well, it just means that ultimately the thing that you've got to do to basically fight back is not necessarily to do anything illegal or not necessarily to find out where their legal inaccuracies are or whatever, but to show the people that they're trying to sell the farms to that all this normal stuff is going on and freak them out and then leave all these lawyers who've been busting their hump to chasing that account in the lurch.
Mm. Mm.
I think that's actually kind of fitting. You know, you go from $790 an hour to nothing.
Yeah, well, the gentleman in concern has probably got a few other accounts, but I don't think I think his reputation does hang a lot on this.
Yeah, well, I that's why he got given the gig, wouldn't it?
Yep.
Mm. All right. Big egos, big money, big scumbaggery. Thank you, Liz, for joining me today. And if there's anything else that you think you might have left out that you want to put out there, or how can people help out or get more information?
As I think I've said before, the best thing to do is talk about it to everybody and say, listen to Vinny's show, and I'll send their statements of claim and stuff, and I'll send my replies, and if people want a bit of late night reading, they might like whatever you want to put up there, Vinny.
Well, see, I can upload the PDFs to the website, and people will be able to download that, and I'll put links to it as well. So that way you can have a veritable little army of people out there potentially who would be willing to do a little bit of late-night reading and, in this case, a little bit of late-night listening.
Yeah, well, often people come up with good practical suggestions the things too, you know.
Yep.
Yeah.
Takes a village to raise a family. It also takes a village to save one too.
That's it. That's it.
All right. Well, Liz Lambert, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Vinny.